The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
It is time. Well, let me start. I just drove up yesterday with my kids from Houston, Texas, and as I was driving up here, it reminded me of a story that took place in Houston back in the fall, and it just kind of came to my mind again. And the story was about a Houston man who died and went to hell. Now, this very, very rarely happens. You know, we're in good, we're in Texas, we're in God's country, God loves Houston, but every so often, someone slips through the cracks. Now, this poor Houstonian is down in hell, and it is miserable. It's 95 degrees, it's 85% humidity, all the sinners are shoveling coal, everybody's miserable. But as the devil looks out and surveys his reign, he notices that the Houstonian is laughing and clapping. And he goes over to him with his pitchfork and sticks him and says, "What are you laughing about, Houstonian?" And he said, "You know, I'm having a great time. This reminds me of the picnic we had every 4th of July with my business. I'm having a great time." He said, "I'll show you." So the devil goes over and he pumps it up so it's now 100 degrees and 95% humidity. But you guessed it, he's still laughing, he's still clapping, he's all happy. "What are you happy about? This reminds me of a great party we had every July with my relatives. We're having a great..." "Oh, I'll show you." He goes back, he pumps it up. It's now 115 degrees and 99% humidity. But he's still laughing because it reminds him of the family reunion they have every August. Well, finally the devil says, "I'll get you, buddy." He goes over to the thermostat, but instead of putting it up, he puts it down, 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 till it's negative 10 degrees. There's snow and ice everywhere. The breath from the sinners is so thick you can't see, but the devil reaches out and parts the fog, and guess what? Not only is our Houstonian still clapping and laughing, he is now cheering. And the devil goes over to him and says, "What are you cheering about, Houstonian?" And he said, "Look around you. This can only mean one thing. The Houston Astros must have just won the World Series." So, that you need to understand, I'm writing a new apologetics book, and that's one of my proofs that God still does miracles. Okay? I mean, I think it's proof. It's like the other miracle God did was when you Louisiana people won the Super Bowl a while ago. See, God does that to people that have natural disasters. It's kind of a nice little way to make us feel a little bit better about ourselves. It'll probably never happen again. Well, there was the Mets in 69. That was a miracle too, but anyway. All right. What I'm going to talk about today is I am a big C.S. Lewis person, and I'm also a big fan of classical Christian education. And I, of course, believe that if C.S. Lewis were living today, he'd be a huge fan of classical Christian education. But how can one prove that? Well, I'm going to look today at the Chronicles of Narnia, and then tomorrow at 4:30, about the same time, I think next door, at 4:30 tomorrow, I'm going to talk about the Space Trilogy. And I'm going to show that the vision that Lewis lays forth in those books, a sort of pedagogical vision, comes very close, I believe, to what we're doing in classical Christian education. And so those are the links I'm going to make today and hopefully inspire you and hopefully make you go back and look at Narnia again to see that, you know what, there is a sort of educational pedagogy here if you look carefully. Now, the first thing I see when I read the Chronicles of Narnia is that, like in classical, I'm going to just say CCE, so I don't have to keep saying that. Like in CCE, Lewis writes in a way that kids can understand, in a way that they can enjoy, in a way that they can share, but he never dumbs down what he is saying. Instead of talking down to the children who are reading his books, he takes a hold of them and lifts them up into higher realms of thought. And we could spend all time giving, I'm going to just give you two examples. Two of the things that are so important for students of all ages to learn. Number one of the most important elements of classical philosophy is Plato's allegory of the cave. How do you teach that to kids? The second thing is one of the most destructive ideas to come out of the last couple hundred years was Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch or Superman. And I want to show you that these two difficult concepts, Plato's allegory of the cave, Nietzsche's Superman, we have to work to get our college students to understand them. Lewis finds a way in the Chronicles of Narnia to make those ideas come alive in a concrete way that the students can, number one, admire, and number one, see the dangers, okay? Because one of them is good and one of them is bad. Now, most of you have studied Plato's allegory of the cave. He's got this idea that all of us, humanity, we are like people who have grown up in a cave. And we are chained to these chairs and we're facing the back wall. And our whole life we've been chained and we've been watching the wall. Now, behind us is a roaring fire, and in between the fire and our backs are puppeteers holding up puppets of all the things outside, trees and animals and people, all of that stuff, and they're parading them, and the fire throws the shadow of those puppets onto the wall, and our whole life, what we think is reality, is really the shadow of a shadow. Because the puppets themselves are a shadow, and then what they're looking at is shadows of the puppets. And Plato's trying to tell us that in many ways, that is our human condition. We don't know the real. We think that what we're looking at on the cave wall is goodness and truth and beauty. But what we're seeing is just imitations. The real good, with a capital G, truth with a capital T, beauty with a capital B, really resides outside of the cave in the real world. And then Plato tells us a story about a man who somehow broke his chains and turned around. And at first he was blinded by the fire. But after a while, he got more used to it. He was able to move out. He was able to discern the puppets, that they weren't real. And if he was really brave, he would move out of the cave and see the real world and then recognize that what he thought was real was just a shadow. And if he's a true philosopher, he will go back into the cave and try to free the minds of the other prisoners, most of whom will put him to death, which is Plato's way of looking at Socrates, but it's also in a weird way a foreshadowing of Christ. All right, that's kind of a difficult concept to explain to kids. But how many of you have read The Silver Chair? Excellent, excellent book. In it, we have two kids, Jill and Eustace. We're still waiting for the Silver Chair movie, by the way. It's up and down, it's up and down, but now it's up again. We'll see the green light. But Eustace and Jill, and along with Puddleglum, have gone to rescue Prince Rillian, who is the son of Prince Caspian, right, King Caspian. And Prince Rillian has been kidnapped by this green witch and is kept a prisoner in her underland, her underworld lair. And the kids spend much of the book trying to find Rillian. Well, finally, they make it all the way underneath. They are able to free Rillian from the silver chair that he's been captured, and they're about to leave and go back to Narnia when suddenly the witch comes in. Now, the first time you read the book, you think that she'll try to kill him or zap him or something, but she doesn't do that. She immediately realizes that they now know the truth, that their eyes are opened. And so instead of trying something violent or active, she goes over to the fire and she throws some green dust in there. And immediately it starts to smell like you're in Colorado, right? I've got some Colorado folks out there. Okay, you got that? Okay, that was a little slow. Okay, anyway. You know, it's really funny because I always speak for Summit, which is like the most conservative worldview academy in the world, and they're in Manitou Springs, which used to be the marijuana capital of the world. Now the whole state is the marijuana capital. But anyway, everything gets a little bit hazy and sort of dark and heavy, and the witch takes out her mandolin, and she begins to strum it rhythmically. And she says, "Where are you going, children?" We're going up there. Up there? What do you mean, up there? This is the world. There is no up there. Well, no. Up there, where the sun shines. Sun? What do you mean by this word? How peculiar. What is this sun? Well, you see that torch over there? Well, imagine if it got bigger and bigger and bigger and it hung that's the sun. Oh, I see. We're playing a game. You looked at a torch and wondered, what would it be like if it got bigger and bigger? And you imagine this thing that you call sun. Oh, how wonderful. But really, children, you're too old for such games. Well, there's Aslan. Who's Aslan? What a peculiar name. He's a lion. What's a lion? Do you mean anything by the word? Well, have you ever seen a cat? Of course. I love cats, because evil people always love them. I love cats, right? Well, imagine some Coloradoan with a cat's going to come get me right now. Anyway, he says, imagine if that cat got bigger and bigger and had a mane. It would be a lion. Oh, I see. We're playing the game again. But really, children, you're much too old for such games. It's time to become part of my world, the only world there is. Now, what he's doing many things, okay? But one of the things Lewis is doing there is reworking the allegory of the cave, right? That witch is convincing them that these shadows are reality and not the reality out there. But, dare I say it, Lewis does Plato one better. And it's not easy to do Plato one better, but he does, because I want you to think about it. What I've just given you is the allegory of the cave, but with one major difference. The kids who come into her lair have already been in the real world. They know that there really is a sun. They felt it on their face. They've met, as some of them have met Aslan. They've seen real lions, and yet, in a matter of 10 minutes, she convinces them that everything they know is real is not real. It's just an illusion. Only these pragmatic, practical things of the earth are real. Now, whether Lewis meant it or not, this is a great allegory for those parents, right, who invest 18 years homeschooling their kids, sending them to classical Christian, do all of this wonderful stuff, train them in the good, the true, and the beautiful, and then for a little bit of pride, I guess, you send your kid to Harvard so that Harvard can destroy everything you did in one semester, okay? Think carefully. Now, if that is the sort of calling on your child to go to an Ivy League and do something, okay. But if it's not, don't let pride make you undo everything you've done. Okay? But Lewis is explaining in a way that all kids and all adults can understand that this world has a way of whittling us down and convincing us that this is real and there's no such thing as God or virtue or truth or goodness or beauty. But you see, without ever dumbing it down, Lewis is taking his children's audience and taking them up so they can understand this. One of the things you're doing at a classical Christian school is trying to free their minds from what Bacon called the idols of the marketplace. You're trying to show them the real sun that is behind the torch, the real lion that is behind the cat. Let me give you one more example. Nietzsche's Übermensch, or overman, or more familiarly, we say Superman, right? According to Nietzsche, right, morality is just a man-made thing. Right? It's all made up to keep people in check. He calls it a slave ethic. Weak people make up morality to keep strong people from taking control. Right? But Nietzsche said what he calls for, this Übermensch or overman, is somebody who is willing to move, the title of his book, beyond good and evil, to move beyond schoolboy ethics, Boy Scout ethics, and assert his will to power. That's what we need. We need a Superman that will rise above what Henry P. Doolittle calls middle-class morality, and My Fair Lady, rise above that and have the courage to assert himself as an authority above all of that pathetic virtue. Now, how are you going to explain something like that and the danger of something like that to a young person? Well, how many of you read The Magician's Nephew? Okay. How many of you read it first? Shame on you. Okay, we'll talk about that later, okay? The proper order, the worst publishing decision since Gutenberg, okay? was to publish in the order of Narnian chronology. You must start with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Please, especially with your kids, please do that. Notice that Hollywood was smart enough to do that, right? And so did the BBC when they made their little things. I mean, please do it in the right order. But in The Magician's Nephew, Diggory, who will grow up to be Professor Kirk, right, is living with his mother who's dying of cancer, and he's got his uncle and aunt there. And his uncle, Uncle Andrew, is a magician who's working with the black arts. And it's kind of a complex plot if you haven't read it, but Diggory and his friend Polly are going through the sort of attic crawl space of these apartments, and by mistake, they end up going into Uncle Andrew's room. And Uncle Andrew turns around, and there he is. And on the table are these rings that are humming. And Polly likes it. You know, she goes, oh, they're so shiny. They're really nice, right? And Uncle Andrew tricks her into putting one on. And the moment she does, she disappears. Boom. Just like when Bilbo puts on the ring, right? Lord, boom, he's gone, right? And Diggory's horrified. And as he starts to talk to his uncle, he finds out that those rings have dust from Atlantis, right? They're magic rings. And he is pretty sure that one set of rings will take you into this other world, and the other set of rings will take you back. But he doesn't want to risk it himself. So he's been sending poor little guinea pigs out there. And of course, the guinea pigs can't come back. They can't move it to their other finger or something like that. And so what he says to Diggory is, if you want to save Polly, you need to take two comeback rings and go and bring her back. And he's, how can you do this? How can you do this to Polly? How can you, this is terrible. And why did you, you know, he's almost as upset about the guinea pigs as the girl. But anyway, why did you do this, right? And he starts to explain, well, I am doing a great experiment. No knowledge is ever gained without any risk. Well, why didn't you go yourself? That's what Uncle Andrew does. What, me? I can't go. That's like asking a general to fight alongside of his army men, right? No, I am the one. I am the adept. I am the mathematician, the musician, I am the magician who is doing the experiment. You might as well think I should have asked the guinea pigs permission before I sent them. And he goes on and on and on. And he finally says, no, Diggory, you need to understand, for people like me, we have a sad and lonely destiny that we must uphold. And Lewis says that for a moment, Diggory was fooled because his uncle looked so, you know, noble and so suffering that for a moment he thought, oh, what a wonderful man. And then suddenly he remembered the ugly look on Uncle Andrew's face when Polly put on the ring and disappeared. And then he saw through it and said, all that means is you think you can do anything you like to get anything you want. Hans Christian Andersen wrote a story about that. What's it called? It's called The Emperor's New Clothes, right? Sometimes children see through things that we as adults are fooled by, right? A lot of very intelligent people were fooled by Hitler or fooled by Stalin or fooled by Lenin or fooled by Castro and are still fooled by these people, right? Sometimes the smarter you are, the easier it is to fool you, right? But Diggory immediately sees the truth of what it is. And one of the great insights is, when Diggory is sort of not sure whether he wants to risk it and go, then Uncle Andrew says to him, I hope no nephew of mine is going to wear the white feather. White feather is what you get. I just took my daughter, we're watching Downton Abbey, and those girls coming in and giving white feathers. Really nasty, man. Oh, yeah, go for it. And there's a great movie called The Four Feathers. But basically he's saying, are you cowardly? Why don't you show courage? Now, I want you to notice what Uncle Andrew's done here, okay? Uncle Andrew considers himself to have risen beyond middle-class morality, but he expects Diggory to still follow the classical virtue of courage. You see? Later on, they meet Queen Jadis, who will become the White Witch, and we find out that she has exactly the same mindset, and she actually says the same words. Ours is a high and lonely destiny. And Lewis says, but you know what? It sounded a lot better when she said it than when Uncle Andrew did, because Uncle Andrew was not 10 feet tall and dazzlingly beautiful. He understands that, again, it's easy to be fooled by an ubermensch who has that charisma, and that's the word that Nietzsche uses. They have a certain charisma that allows them to assert that will to power. So again, Lewis is teaching difficult but important concepts to children, but in a way that they can understand. And at its best, that's what CCE does. We teach them these virtues, but by embodying them in stories and other things that we can take them and bring them up, because we realize that they are capable of learning a lot more than we think they can. All right, so far I've told you what you all know, that one of the things that's important to CCE is a kind of rigor, a refusal to dumb down, a desire to make the kids work and draw them up to your level. But if that's all we do, that's not enough. There are a lot of prep schools that do that, but are missing the essential ingredient of CCE. And that essential ingredient that is just as important to CCE as Narnia is that both Lewis and classical Christian schools treat young people as moral, ethical agents, right? Neither Lewis nor classical Christian school is fooled by that John Dewey nonsense we call values clarification. One of the most destructive things that ever happened to the public school is values clarification, which means the opposite of what it sounds like it means. What values clarification means is we are helping the kids to come up with their own values and own morality. So it's the very opposite of what it sounds, sort of like the Common Core, which sounds like your kids are reading the Iliad and the Odyssey. Sorry, that's not what it means. All right, very, very tricky, just like accountability means giving stupid tests that you have to teach to. It doesn't cause any accountability. It just destroys true pedagogy. So watch out for the language that's used, please, okay? Okay, now, what do I mean by moral, ethical agents, okay? That when we go to Narnia, when we go to a good CCE school, we are trying to lay down standards for these children that we also follow ourselves. That virtue is not man-made, it exists, and the question is, will we adapt ourselves to it or not, right? Will we live up to it, will we rebel, or will we obey? And that choice is before us. Now, I don't know whether or not there's this thing called an age of accountability, you know, theologians debate, whether or not there is. I think most of you are parents here, you understand that the sinful nature manifests itself almost immediately, okay? I don't want to sound pessimistic, but it's there. We also see God's glory in these children, but it's there. What is the first word a child learns? No! Forget about grandpa. No is the first word. And the second word, mine, okay? After that, we'll work on mommy, daddy, grandma, and grandpa, okay? So we understand that kids are moral, ethical agents that make choices. And after today, please go read the Narnia again and look for this, because in every single book, almost every single one of the child heroes will have a moment where they have done something wrong, that they know they've done wrong, and Aslan will approach them, the Lion King, will approach them and do what I call like a little catechism. He does a series of questions and answers so that the child will understand, one, exactly what he's done wrong, and number two, why he chose that wrong action. He wasn't fooled. It wasn't just, hormones or something. I'm a little young for that. It wasn't even the devil made. It's they knew they were doing it wrong, and yet they did it. And Aslan will not stop until they've not only repented, but come to a full understanding of what they've done wrong, why it's wrong, and how they can maybe not do it again. So Aslan takes them through that, okay? And the one question he never asked the child is, I'm not hurting your self-esteem, am I? Okay? That's the second most destructive, the self-esteem movement, okay? Ask now, once the child understands and makes a confession, then Aslan will forgive them and embrace them and blow on them and say, now you are a lioness. You want Aslan to say that to you? Now you are a lioness, okay? But what Aslan does not say is, oh, it's okay. No. What you did was wrong, but I still love you. That's how we should raise our children. That's how we should teach our students. They need to understand this was wrong, but you are still valuable. You made a bad choice, and it might have some bad consequences, but you are valuable. Let me give you some examples, because it happens again and again and again. Let's start with The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Lucy finds the magician's book. There's this wonderful magic, full of magic spells. And most of you probably know the scene. And as she's going through it, she comes upon a spell that will make you beautiful beyond all mortals, right? And for a moment, she wants to say, because she was always the less pretty one, Susan was the more pretty one, and she's very, very tempted to say it, but as she watches, the book moves, and she sees that if she says the spell, she'll become as beautiful as Helen of Troy, and Calormen will go to war with Narnia, or Arkenland, and all these things will happen, right? And then suddenly Aslan's face appears, and she closes it, right? And the book is like life. Once you turn it, you can't go back. It keeps moving this way, right? There's no rewind button, okay? Now, she did the right thing, but she's still a little bit miffed because she didn't say the spell that will make her beautiful, surpassing all mortals. And so a little bit later, she comes upon a book that will let you hear what your friends are saying about you. Now, because she's already upset that basically her desire was stopped, that she says the spell. And you know what? She says it quickly before she changes her mind, right? That's proof that we know we're sinning when we do it more quickly so our conscience won't kick in, right? We know what we're doing. That's the point, okay? We know what... She says the spell, and suddenly the book moves around, and she sees one of her good friends who's in a carriage with sort of the school bully. And the bully is bullying Lucy's friend until Lucy's friend says, "Ah, Lucy, that kid, I was getting kind of tired of her." And she's like, "Oh, you little beast, I'll never be your friend again," and closes the page. Okay. Now, a little bit longer she goes on, and she finds the spell that will make invisible things visible. That's why she's there. And suddenly, Aslan becomes visible. And they start talking to each other, right, back and forth. And then Aslan, after greeting her, he questions her about what she did. "Lucy, I believe you were eavesdropping." "No, no, it wasn't eavesdropping, it was magic." "It's still eavesdropping, even if it's magic," okay, right? You know, it's wonderful. You can look, you know, I can look on my phone and watch you. It's still eavesdropping, right? Even if it's technology, right? We kind of shield ourselves. Adults think that way as well. And they start talking back and forth, and then Lucy says, "Yeah, I can't believe she said that about me. I don't think I'll ever forget what she said." And Aslan says, "No, you won't." "What? Oh, Aslan, I didn't expect you to say that. You mean if I didn't read that spell, we would have gone on and been best friends all of our lives?" And Aslan says, "Lucy, didn't I tell you once before in Prince Caspian? No one is ever told what might have happened." So there is a consequence to her action. Aslan forgives her, okay? And yes, Lucy understands now that girl was just scared, but the doubt will always be in the back of your mind. Right? When you do something like that, the doubt will always be there. There are consequences. Now, how many of you saw the movie, Voyage of the Dawn Treader? I mean, as a movie, I enjoyed it. It parted quite a bit. I like the old Sinbad the Sailor movie, so I enjoyed it as a movie. But they really changed that scene, and they really kind of messed it up. Now, they did something really, really cool, okay? What happens is, instead of not saying the spell to make herself beautiful, she rips the page out, and when she's back in the Dawn Treader, the ship, she says it. All of a sudden, there's a magic door. She walks in. And now she is Susan. She is her prettier sister. And it's really cool. It's very well done. All that sort of stuff is ultra gold. You know, now the sailors like her and all that. But then it suddenly turns out that her brothers, Edmund and Peter, have never heard of Narnia. Because without Lucy, no one ever found Narnia. So, oh my gosh, this is terrible. And then all of a sudden, everything's over and everything's fine. Right? And then later on, she learns a message that she passes down to this little girl who's a stowaway. They added her. She's a little stowaway. And at the end, the little girl says, "Oh, Lucy, when I grow up, I want to be just like you." And Lucy says, "When you grow up, you should be just like yourself." Now, that's a sweet message, okay? But this generation of kids has had that told to them every single day of their life, okay? Now, the message that this generation needs is choices have consequences. But if you watch the movie again, the bad choice she makes has absolutely no consequences whatsoever. That's the problem. It was a cool scene. I understood what they were doing. But they robbed young people of a chance to understand that, you know, if you're the Wile E. Coyote and you fall off a cliff, you don't come back in the next scene. Okay? There are consequences to what you do. Let me give another example. This is actually from The Silver Chair again. What happens there is that Eustace, who's in the third book, he and a new girl named Jill Pole. By the way, did any of you notice that at the end of the movie, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, he goes back home and his Aunt Alberta says, "Oh, Eustace, your friend Jill Pole is here." Did you notice that? So they were setting us up for the next movie, but then it didn't happen. But it still might happen. It's in limbo forever, okay? I think Amazon will probably make the movie first, okay? So we'll see. Anyway, we'll see what happens, okay? So what happens is that they go through this door, it's really magical, and they end up not in Narnia proper, but they end up on a super high cliff in Aslan's country, kind of the frontier of what will be heaven of Aslan's country. And there's a huge cliff there. I mean, it's just like millions of miles down. And Eustace is afraid of heights, but Jill is not. And so out of vanity, to show off, I'm not afraid like this silly boy, she walks right to the edge. And she doesn't realize yet that it's like a million-mile drop. And Eustace is terrified and tries to pull her back. And in doing it, Eustace goes off, right down the mountain. Right? Now, luckily, Aslan appears and blows him into Narnia, right? And then later on, Aslan starts to have a conversation with Jill Pole about her choices and her decisions. What happened to the boy? What happened to the boy, human child? Well, he fell. He fell? Well, he was really close to the edge of the cliff. Why was he close to the edge of the cliff? Human child? Well, I was kind of, he was trying to save me. Why were you at the edge of the cliff, human child? I was showing off, sir. That is a good answer, human child. See, it's not just, let me spank you. You need to understand what you did wrong and why you did it. You need to understand that you did something wrong that was inspired by vanity, a kind of showing off that led to what could have been the death of Eustace if Aslan hadn't saved him. But guess what? Choices always have consequences. Because if you've read that book, you will know that Aslan teaches Jill four signs to help her find Prince Rillian. He was supposed to tell them to both of them at the same time, but now only Jill hears it, and because of that, they end up messing up the very first sign that would have gotten them help to get Rillian. Instead, they lose that help. And guess what happens to Jill? She ends up, because she has no fear of heights, but she has claustrophobia. And because she did it the wrong way and they didn't get help, she ends up having to go on her hands and knees through a terrible, you know, tunnel under the earth. And I'm a little claustrophobic. I was just reading that. Ugh, okay. Weren't we watching some TV where, I wouldn't have seen that movie. Anyway, it's like I was getting all crazy watching it. But anyway, again, the choices have consequences. Now, maybe the best example of all, though, of this catechism, this making the child understand, is in The Magician's Nephew. Right? Now, in The Magician's Nephew, once they understand how to use the rings, they end up going to a dead world called Charn. And they go into a room of statues, and at the end of the hall is this giant woman who's very, very beautiful, but also looks very, very cruel. And next to her is a little thing with a bell on it. And there's a little poem that says, hey, go ahead and ring the bell, right? And bide the danger, or wonder till it drives you mad what would have happened if you had. And he's like, oh, I've got to ring the bell. And the girl, Polly's like, no, you don't. Yes, I've got to ring it. I've got to. No, you don't. There's nothing wrong with it. You don't have to do that. Okay? I've got to ring the bell. And he rings it, and he wakes. And first of all, Jill tries to stop him, and he grabs her and viciously pulls her hand behind her back, hurts her, and then he rings the bell and wakes up Jadis, who ends up, when they end up going to Narnia at its birth, he ends up bringing evil, bringing the devil into Narnia at its very birth. And he goes to Aslan because he wants help for his mother. If you remember, she's dying of cancer back in London. And he goes to her, and Aslan does another little question and answer, okay? Why is that queen here? Well, she followed us here. Oh, really? Okay. Where did she come from? Well, she came from the land called Charn, and she woke up. She woke up? Well, I guess I woke her up. Why did you wake her up? I wanted to see what would happen if I rang a bell. Aslan, I really think I was enchanted. Were you? No, I see now I was just fooling. Polly was right. He wasn't really enchanted. He didn't have to do it. The devil didn't make him do it, okay? He didn't have to do it, right? But he did it, and it's brought terrible consequences. But he needs to understand step by step. It's got to be layered away from him until he's ready to look at, we would even say, his own depravity, but then also understand that Aslan wants to draw him out of that, right? See, Satan would say, yeah, you're a sinner and stay there, right? Aslan says, you're a sinner, but let me draw you out, okay? And he actually gives Diggory a chance to help undo the wrong that he did, which is wonderful. He's got to go all the way up to this like inaccessible little Garden of Eden, so all the way top, and there's a tree in the garden with apples. He needs to pluck one of the apples and bring it back to Aslan, and he needs to do it. And he gets there, and he plucks the apple, and he should have put it in his pocket right away, but he wanted to smell it, and he looked at it. It was so beautiful, and for a moment, he thought, why don't I take one of these apples, right? He's drawn like Eve, right? And then suddenly, there's a little phoenix on the top, and a later book tells us it's actually Aslan, and he puts it away. Right? Now, Lewis says, now, you know, he might have taken the apple if he hadn't seen the phoenix, but then again, he might not have taken it, because Magician's Nephew takes place about 1900, late Victorian age. He says, because in Diggory's day, I believe, things like thou shalt not steal were much better instilled in young people. Okay? Our job is not just to teach morality, but to instill it in them, to allow them to see it, to see the importance of it, both as a thing of beauty and also pragmatically, as something that will save your life and not lead it. But the point is that, and that's a very, very strong critique of the 20th century to say, we don't instill those rules anymore. We don't teach it. It's got to be, you've got to grow up so that it's taught to you without words. Right? I've been both 27 years a Yankee, 27 years a Texan. I would say the South is still a little better at instilling those values in you from an early child. We do it in the North, but the idea of growing up as a gentleman and lady and doing something because it's right. Northern mothers need to learn to say to their girls what Southern mothers say, don't be ugly, dear. Okay? Did your mother ever say that to you? It's very important because you need to understand that sinful behavior, vain behavior, is ugly. I think a kid understands that more than, especially a girl understands that more than anything. And I don't want to be like that. Right? So you're instilling this is what's happening at a good classical Christian education. You're teaching them the virtue and you're trying to instill it into them and make it lovely. Now, we think that Diggory has passed the test, but a moment later, the White Witch, she's the White Witch now because she's eaten the apple. It has made her eternal and given her everlasting youth, but now her face is white, white as salt. Her face wasn't white when she was Queen Jadis. And she goes over to Diggory and tries to tempt him to take the apple. And Diggory's like, well, I think I'd rather live a normal life and then die and go to heaven with all my family. And then the witch does something. I'm sorry, I've read a lot of books in my life. I don't know if any book, for child or adult, has ever forced its hero to make a more difficult decision. Not just children, but adult novels. Because the witch says, okay, you won't take the apple for yourself. What about that mother you say you love? Take it back to her, one bite, and she'll be healed. What kind of a boy are you? You would rather let your mother die so you can run errands for a wild line in a world that's got nothing to do with you? My God, has anybody ever had to face that decision? Oh my gosh. But Diggory understands, partly because he's seen Uncle Andrew and seen what it does, because he understands the problem of the Nietzschean superhero, and he understands that the ends don't justify the means, and a wrong doesn't become a right, and he resists doing it. Unbelievable. And he goes back, and he gives Aslan the apple. Aslan lets him throw it, and he plants a tree of protection that will protect Narnia for 100 years, so she'll have a beautiful sort of dawn before evil starts creeping in. And then once the tree grows, he says, Diggory, go pluck an apple and bring it home to your mother. And another reason why you have to read Magician's Nephew number 6 is because in The Magician's Nephew, Diggory talks to him and Aslan tells him, if you had brought back the witch's apple, understand it would have worked. The magic always works, but a time would have come when both of you would have agreed it would have been better if she had died in that illness. What a message to teach a kid, right? Harvard doesn't teach messages like that anymore, okay? This is a difficult message. Now, That's what would have happened with a stolen apple, not with this one that I give you. In your world, it will not give eternal life, but it will heal. Now, if you've read Narnia in the proper order, you will know something, that no one is ever told what would have happened. But Diggory's told, right? Is Lewis breaking the rules? No, because Diggory does something right for the first time. One of the kids makes the right decision. And now the reward is to understand. I don't know that we're all going to get a reward like that, and heaven will understand. But, I mean, if you read it in the right order, then it should shock you and say, wait a minute, the rules are being bent because this child, this boy hero, has done something right. Okay? So again, we need to treat our students as moral, ethical agents who are able to understand right and wrong, and who are able to understand when they did something wrong and why they did it wrong, but then be brought back into the fold. Okay? Again, do not say, that's okay. Say, what you did was wrong, but I still love you, I still affirm you, you are still special. That is not the self-esteem movement. The self-esteem movement means protecting your students from all guilt and shame. If you protect young people from guilt and shame, you will produce a race of monsters. Okay? Really, this is really, really dangerous. I mean, if we were intentionally trying to destroy the next generation, we couldn't do a better job than the self-esteem movement. Okay? Again, but don't go back to, you know, whether this is true or not, the old days, you're a sinner and smacking them. I think Mark Twain invented a lot of that, and Nathaniel Hawthorne and stuff. I mean, I think they overdo it a little bit. But anyway, again, moral ethical agents who need to learn and grow and understand that choices have consequences. Okay, so we have seen that classical Christian education does not dumb down things, right? It maintains rigor, and it treats kids as moral ethical agents. But there's another ingredient that is so important, and that's what sets this apart from maybe some old schools that were maybe a little bit too... Oh my God, oh no, I still have time. All right. The great thing about classical Christian schools and about Narnia is it is a serious place of moral ethical decisions, a place of learning, a place of growth, a place of difficult decisions, but it's also a place of joy. Okay? My son over here teaches at the Geneva School of Burning. Where are my Geneva Burning people? Okay? Do you know what they do? Every year on the 100th day of school, all the kindergartners dress up as if they were 100 years old. And they march around the school with their little walkers and their wigs, and I love it. The boys are all wearing suspenders, and it is. Do any of your other schools do that? Oh, some of you do. Good, do it. This is a great idea. I don't know where it started. Probably Doug Wilson. He thinks of everything. And I mean, it is the greatest thing. It is full of joy. Every month, the parents get together and they do some kind of big party where they dress up. And they might dress up as like Lord of the Rings or fairy tales or something like that. They have fun and joy. One of the things they left out of the movie of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe boggles my mind, okay? If you've read the book, you will know that right after Aslan comes back from the dead, right? Death itself will start working backwards. Before the girls get on his back and they rush off to the witch's castle, do you remember what happens? They roll around, they play this wild play where they're rolling around in the grass together. And whether it was like playing with a tornado or playing with a kitten, Lucy could never say. But after they were done, they're exhausted, laying in the grass, panting. They've never had so much fun. They leave that out of a movie, right? That, remember, movie, kinema, means kinetic, cinema. It's very, very visual, but they leave it out because they don't understand it, right? There is an important need for joy and laughter, for food and fellowship. Aslan is always laying out feasts for the kids. And Focus on the Family always misses this part. He's always giving them wine. I'm sorry, but if you read it carefully, the kids are drinking. I mean, they're 8 years old? They're always drinking wine, okay? And every reference is left out of the Focus on the Family radio play. We don't mention that, okay? But I mean, they have fun. They have joy, right? And one of the things that Narnia does is what classical Christian education is best at, and that is teaching through story and myth, inviting your students into ultimately the story of creation, fall, redemption, and reconciliation. That's the big meta-narrative, as we call it today. But what you're doing is you're not only teaching them through story, You're inviting them into the story. So again, you need to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first. Why? Because it is the redemption story of Narnia. It's the gospel story of Narnia. That's where you begin. If a friend of yours became a Christian at age 35 and said, I want to read the Bible, where do I start? Would you say start in Genesis and read straight through? No, you should start with the Gospels. Then you can go back later. You start with the gospel story, you be part, and then when you get to Prince Caspian, the second book, then you're part of a restoration story. Things have gone bad, and Aslan has come and restored them. You join into that story. Okay, how many of you teach history? Are you history teachers? Okay. Be very, very thankful you teach at a CCE school, because if you were teaching at a regular public school, you wouldn't be teaching history. You would be teaching social studies, which is a totally different thing. I'm 54. When I was a kid, they were teaching social studies. It's been going on for a while, okay? It's not history. My kids take a class in American history. They spend the first half of the year on the Indians, okay? Now, the Indians are really cool, okay? But that's anthropology, okay? And by the way, even though they spend 6 months on the Indians, it doesn't mean they respect them at all. Multiculturalism doesn't mean you respect, say, Hispanic or Asian culture. It just means you use them to destroy Western culture. There is absolutely no... Do you know what group of people has the most respect for the Indians? I'll tell you. It is probably, well, it used to be one of the most conservative groups in our country. Until they became the gender-neutral scouts, they were called the Boy Scouts. Did you miss that joke? Okay. You know that. Okay. The Boy Scouts, I think, understand the Indians better than any other group, and they respect them. They respect their traditions. They respect Sam Houston, our buddy over there, he actually joined an Indian tribe. Okay? Davy Crockett, once he defeated the Creeks, who were killing people, then when they became citizens, he fought Andrew Jackson to give them their rights. Andrew Jackson wasn't a very nice guy. And then he said, I'm out of here. I'm going to the Alamo. That's it. I'm going over here. Yeah, San Antonio, great place. Okay? So again, social studies is not history. Social studies is, again, basically sociology, anthropology, and we are studying the past as an object over which we are superior. History, when it's properly taught, means taking your students and bringing them into the past so they can understand and be part of the past, right? You're not looking down on them. You're not studying them as an object. You are participating. And you know what? True history is the most joyous thing when it's taught properly. If you know Prince Caspian, you will know that a group of former pirates known as the Telmarines have seized control of Narnia, and they have completely outlawed all the stories about Aslan and the four children and all of that stuff. And the movie's good, but when you watch the movie, they seem to think that Uncle Miraz, the bad guy, is a simple sort of Hitler fellow. He is more Richard Dawkins than Hitler. You understand what I mean? Because what the Telmarines have done is outlawed and censored any talk of Narnia's supernatural past. And they have cut off the trees, they've cut everybody off, and they've done something else. They now teach what we would call revisionist history. They don't teach the true history of Narnia. They teach revisionist, and the revisionist history is 100 times more boring than the real history. You need to invite your students into real history, okay? Okay, before I make my next point, because I always forget when I go, I want you to know that as soon as this is over at 5:15, we have a speaker's dinner that I have to go to. And I hate to be rude and leave, so right at 5:15, we do need to go. But tomorrow, when we end at 5:30, we'll talk, and then I'm going to go over to 8th Day Books, because they got like 10 of my books, if you wanted me to sign a book, and then we'll go to Canon Press. But we will stay together tomorrow. But please forgive me that I do have to leave right afterwards, but I've got a bunch of books out there and stuff like that. And if you buy my book, how many of you have read The Dreaming Stone? Or In the Shadow, my children's novels? Okay, they're there, and my kids are the heroes when they were little. Now they're grown up, but you can get them to sign the book too if you want to. Okay, so again, forgive me if I have to take off. Tomorrow I can hang out. And I will be around later, just come ask me questions. Okay, number four, not only do Narnia and classical Christian education invite students into a sense of joy. Just as important, they invite students to experience what Lewis liked to call the numinous. Now, he got that word from a book by Rudolf Otto called The Idea of the Holy. That book's written in German. You'll have to read a translation, unless you know German, read a translation as I did. Rudolf Otto, O-T-T-O, The Idea of the Holy. And he coins this word in German and then in English of the numinous. Now, what is the numinous? Well, the way Otto describes it is The numinous is what Isaiah feels in Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord holy and mighty on his throne, and I came before him, and the smoke was pouring out. And I said, O Lord, I am a man of unclean lips from a people of unclean lips. And he falls on his face, right? And then God lifts him up, right? That's the numinous. That's the kind of fear, the uncanny, that gives you goose flesh, like this. Mufasa! That's the first time your kids feel that. Oh, okay. This sort of stuff. It is that feeling of almost being crushed and yet at the same time being affirmed as a full human being. Right? He understands in the presence of God, he falls prostrate. Okay? Now, if you want to make fun of that, it would be, stop groveling. I hate all that groveling and those psalms. So depressing. Nobody gets that? That's Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Okay? What are you doing? We are averting our eyes, dear Lord. Well, don't do it. Okay? That's making fun of that. But there is a proper kind. We all know that the beginning of wisdom is what? The fear of the Lord. That reverent fear of the Lord. Ezekiel chapter 1, when he sees the wheels within the wheels. Or even better, John chapter 4. I hope you all feel the numinous every time you sing the second stanza, holy, 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 all the saints adore thee, casting down their golden crowns around the glassy sea, cherubim and seraphim falling down before you, who wert and art and evermore. So right out of Revelation chapter 4. That's the numinous. Now, Lewis helps us to understand it in a book he wrote called The Problem of Pain. What is the numinous? All right, he says, what if I told you that on the other side of that door was a tiger? You would be afraid. What if I told you on the other side of that door is a ghost? You would also be afraid, but the two kinds of fear would be totally different. They would be not quantitatively, but qualitatively different. The difference between the fear of the wild animal and the fear of the ghost is not a difference in degree, it is a difference in kind. Because the ghost cannot hurt you, right? That was the problem in the Lord of the Rings movie. I love that scene, but ghosts cannot kill you, okay? And that doesn't happen in the novel. It's a cool scene, okay? But they don't seem to understand that the ghost is terrifying because it brings a numinous fear, that goose flesh again, right? Human beings are the only animals that are afraid of their own graveyards, right? Because we feel that, ooh, right? That sense. Now, Narnia is filled with that sense. And if you read Lewis, this is one of the most important things he wanted to do for his child readers, to bring back, to revive that lost sense of the sacred, of the numinous, that almost, like, you know, those of you who go to a liturgical church, sometimes you might feel that sense of the numinous, okay? Now, the best example of it is in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and you probably know this scene when they meet Mr. Beaver, and the kids are all afraid, right? And Mr. Beaver says, I know you're afraid, but don't worry, the word is out, Aslan is on the move. And then Lewis says, now, none of the children knew who Aslan was any more than you do, unless you've already read The Magician's Nephew, okay? Right? Remember that, please, okay? He says, but when they heard that name, something inside them jumped. Suddenly, Peter felt braver and stronger than he'd ever felt before. Edmund, who was about to betray his siblings, felt an inner sense of disgust. Susan felt as you might if a beautiful smell or delicious sound had wafted into the room. And Lucy felt the way you do just before Christmas or before the summer holidays. And admit it, we all felt exactly the same way. Okay, remember, I'm a teacher too. We all felt the same. Not just kids that love holidays. Okay, and what they're feeling, it stays with them. And some of you remember when they first meet Aslan. Of course, Edmund's gone now. The three of them meet him, and he comes out of that pavilion, and he comes up, and C.S. Lewis says that for a moment they looked at him, right? But as they saw his golden mane and his deep, royal, solemn, overwhelming eyes, they found that they could no longer look at him, and they went all trembling. And for the first time in their life, the children realized that something could be beautiful and terrible at the same time. That's what the sacred is, right? That's why a lot of my students at a Baptist school have actually, some of them have become Catholic or Orthodox or Anglican, partly because they are hungry for a sense of the sacred, for a sense of liturgy, for something that is beyond just, you know, a rock band or something like that, right? There's some good to that. I'm going to make fun of everybody. What I'm saying is that we've lost a sense of the sacred, that the feeling you feel when you almost want to cry and laugh at the same time, that beautiful, like I'm sure we're going to feel it when we listen to the choir tomorrow. Like, you know, with like the Cambridge Boy Singers, there's something so pure about it. How many of you got to hear the Gettys 2 years ago in Atlanta? Was that not beautiful? That gives you a sense of the numinous, a sense of being taken out of yourself. That is one of the most important things you are doing for your students at a classical Christian school. You are, I got my son a tie of the School of Athens, right? And what does it say? What does Socrates say? Good. Wisdom begins in wonder. Wisdom begins in wonder. We want them to read the work we have them read and the music and the art, and we want them to have the response of wonder and awe. And here's something you don't see at this public school, gratitude. Whoa. We'll talk about that more tomorrow. But awe and wonder so that you feel it throughout your whole body. Okay? Let me end with Oh, okay. Any fans of The Horse and His Boy? Is that anybody's favorite? Horse and His Boy? Okay. People still don't know if they're going to make that movie. Is it politically incorrect? But anyway, it's got one of the best scenes in all of Narnia. Some of you know it. And by the way, in case you don't know it, Lewis was a huge fan of The Wind in the Willows. And the scene I'm about to tell you when Shasta meets the unwelcome fellow traveler is taken right out of the scene when Rat and Mole meet Pan. You know what I'm talking about? The singer, what is the piper at the Gates of Dawn? I think that's the name of the chapter. Beautiful. I didn't read that as a kid. A lot of Americans don't read it. I read it later on. But read that to your kids, The Wind in the Willows. And don't just show them the Disney movie. It's cute, but read the book to them. But anyway, Shasta is a little boy who was a prince, and he was kidnapped, and he was taken down to Kolorman and raised there and knows nothing about Aslan, right? Thinks that Narnia is bad. And he escapes, and he goes up to Narnia, and in this incredible mystical moment, he comes face to face with Aslan. And when he does, he's absolutely terrified. Go away! Go away! Are you a ghost? Are you a ghost? I'm not a ghost. Does this feel like a ghost? And he breathes on his own. Are you a giant? You might call me a giant, right? And he says, oh, go away. I'm so unfortunate. Tell me your troubles. He tells him his troubles. I do not call you unfortunate. Well, what about all the lions that I met? There was only one lion. But I told you there were two lions. There was only one lion, but he was swift of foot. Suddenly, this boy is being brought in the presence of Aslan himself, of the numinous power. And at first, he's terrified, but in the end, he gets off his course and he kneels on the ground before him. We need to bring our students. Of course, in our world, he's called Jesus, okay? And that's what Aslan is, what the second person of the Trinity would have been like if he'd been incarnated in a world of talking animals. He still is the second. I mean, Lewis says that himself, okay? So he is still the second person of the Trinity, right? He's the one that brings us back to God, the incarnate one. And what we're doing, and even if, as teachers, we're not fully able to bring them into the numinous presence of Christ, you know what we can do? We can make them into people who desire that numinous experience, and who can survive it, okay? Because a lot of people are afraid, okay? Stay away, stay away. Some of you might remember Pope John Paul II wrote a book called Crossing the Threshold of Hope, and he said that for many people, the incarnation is too close. God, stay away. I'll do the rules. Don't come too close. Basically, the entire religion of Islam said, too close, too close. Let's run away, okay? And we have got to raise kids that have a desire, okay, to experience truth and beauty and goodness in the full numinous power. That's how we are preparing their souls, not only to be moral ethical, but to be joyous and to desire the sacred. Wow! Let me close in prayer. I've got to run off. I'm sorry, but I will be here tomorrow, and I'll be here all day tomorrow, so come get me. Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you all. There's so much to cover. If any of you email me, I do have a full outline, but they wanted you to take notes here, so they took out my full outline. That's why, yeah, I'm not lazy. I did write a full outline, but they want you to take notes. So anyway, I will see you all tomorrow about 4:30. Thank you all.